Why did you want to do a book interviewing corporate leaders?
Well, because all these years we're taking out after corporate abuse, unsafe cars, flammable fabrics, pesticide runoffs. You never meet the heads of these companies. You meet their, quote, spokespeople, unquote. You meet their lobbyists. And I've often wondered what it's like to be the head of a company who is basically telling the public they can't do this, they can't meet this safety standard, they can't produce this kind of safeguard, they can't comply with this standard, they can't inform the workers, they can't inform the consumers. Who are these people who rule these giant corporations, who in turn rule the economy, who in turn have such powerful voices in Washington? So we decided to write the book, The Big Boys, and we titled it The Big Boys because that's the way a lot of people in factories and office buildings refer to the boss at the top. You know, the big boy wants this done. And to make a manageable book and one that's interesting not only to people in business to read about how these corporate executives clambered up the ladder of power and how they maneuvered their way to the top and how they use their power. We wanted to make it interesting to people who don't ordinarily read about business topics. So we focused on 9 major corporate executives.
A lot of corporate executives recently have been writing their own memoirs, and some of them, like Lee Iacocca, have become popular figures, heroes in American culture. Did you read their memoirs before setting out to write your book about corporate leaders?
Yeah, so we read a lot of books about the art of Japanese management and various books by professors on entrepreneurship and technocracy and corporations and all the rest of it. But this is a different kind of book. This basically focuses right in on the man at the top. They're all men in the book. The head of U.S. Steel, David Roderick. The head of General Motors, Roger Smith. What kind of people are they? What do they talk about? What are their inhibitions? I mean, it's amazing what they told us in the interviews. Roger Smith didn't allow an interview, but we got interviews with 6 out of 9 of them and repeated interviews, I might add. And they told us things that astonished us, which we can get into in a moment. But the thing is, we asked them, how come you've never said this before? And their answer was revealing. They said, no reporter ever asked us. Which indicates how narrow the questions are very often from the business press.
In the corporate world, you're considered an adversary. How did you ask people for interviews? Were you surprised that corporate leaders granted you interviews?
Well, yes, of course. But we also were not surprised when they didn't grant interviews, like the head of Exxon. You couldn't get near his his office was, any kind of request. It was just, he was totally surrounded by his handlers and his spokespeople. But basically, we went to David Roderick, U.S. Steel, his office. The answer was no, no, no. And then we wrote the chapter on him. And we said, look, you know, we called up once more and we said, look, you know, here's the chapter. Nobody can present your point of view better than you. We interview you according to your own ground rules. You don't want to answer questions on certain topics. You don't have to. You can have the interview recorded to make sure it's accurate. And he said yes. Some of them said yes right away. The head of MCI, the long-distance phone company, Bill McGowan in Washington. I mean, it was, you just called him up. You said, come on over. We spent 10 hours in 3 separate interviews with him.
The head of General Motors, Roger Smith, was one of the people who didn't give you an interview. Now, General Motors had hired a private detective in 1966, I think it was, to track you, and this was after you wrote Unsafe at Any Speed, your critique of the auto industry. Do you think that that had anything to do with not giving you the interview?
Oh, yes, because you know we were been consistent critics of General Motors. But again, the chapter on him would have had more of him had he given us the interview. As it was, we had to read 120 of his speeches going back to 1971 so we could incorporate his say in the chapter. But I think he made a mistake. And the head of Automotive News, Keith Crane, who's a friend of his, several times told us he thought Roger Smith made a mistake not engaging in an interview. I think he would have benefited from it, apart from the book, in the sense that some of the executives who did give us interviews said that they really felt stimulated in the interview. I mean, they're surrounded by people who are very routinized and often sycophants.
You said that you were astonished by some of the things that the corporate leaders told you in the interviews. What's an example of something that astonished you?
Well, Felix Roatan, the investment banker of Lazard Frères firm in New York, he said he thought his profession was vastly overpaid, and he thought that the economy was in a very serious speculative state, was very risk, a very risky posture. And of course, you see the headlines today, and you know the speculators are starting to get caught, and you can see just how fragile all these takeover and acquisition moves have been, and how many people have been fleeced indirectly through these operation of insider trading. The head of U.S. Steel said that he thought Ronald Reagan engaged in too much belligerent talk vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, which undermined the prospects of arms control. He also thought that Ronald Reagan shouldn't have bailed out the big New York banks on their foreign loans. And he also thought that Ronald Reagan was behaving very poorly in producing such a massive deficit. Now, to have the head of U.S. Steel, who often has to go down to Washington to beg for import quotas and subsidies, makes those kinds of statements on the record, is quite extraordinary.
More than, or at least one, chief executive officer admitted to you that most CEOs don't say much in their public speeches. Did you get a sense of why so many corporate leaders are so careful in their public speaking and don't really commit themselves to any major opinions when they're in
public. Well, Ken Galbraith had a comment on that. He said by the time they finish writing the speech for the chief executives, it's so bland that it won't cause a ripple. Because they don't want to say anything provocative because, you know, then they'll start a controversy. A controversy weakens their control over their situation. It broadens the audience of people who are interested. It might alert a senator. It might alert a newspaper. It might alert a TV station. So they're pretty bland. But you can still notice certain trends about the way they think when you read speech after speech after speech. For instance, Roger Smith, you read his speeches, which are fairly dull. But after you've read several dozen of them, you notice certain themes. One is he focuses his attention on the automated factory of the future and never pays any attention to what kind of car is going to come out of that factory. Like it's the Saturn plant, you see, but you never know. Is it going to be a new kind of car? It's like the car is secondary, in contrast to the Japanese, who are focusing heavily on the product. Secondly, you see in his mind very little attention to worker hazards in his plants. He has a General Motors award to scientists who have done well in cancer research. And he goes down to the State Department room, the big room, and has these awards in a dinner fashion once a year. But he doesn't do anything to prevent cancer in the workplace. He doesn't talk about that. And a lot of workers are exposed to fumes, and especially in the paint rooms, that are quite hazardous to them. So all these you begin to pick up by reading these so-called bland speeches. They're really part of corporate archives that shouldn't be ignored, even though they're dull.
The head of U.S. Steel and the head of General Motors were both accountants, and they didn't work in the plants. They didn't make their way up through the plant. Some people say that really puts you at a disadvantage if you're a, quote, bean counter. And some people say, too, that people who are from, say, the world of accounting don't have a commitment to the product. In other words, they might not have a commitment to cars or to steel. Their commitment is more to the bottom line. And having interviewed a lot of business leaders, I wonder if you think that that's true.
It is true. Roger Smith never ran an auto division in his entire career at General Motors. He now heads General Motors. He came up by financial analysis. And David Roderick was a financial analyst, too. He doesn't like to be called an accountant. He really objected to that when we sort of referred to him that way. But he doesn't have that kind of commitment to steel that, say, his predecessor had, who ran a steel mill in Pennsylvania. Now, he'll say, so what? The only job he has is to make money for the shareholders, whether he makes it selling clothes, steel, trampolines, cosmetics, doesn't make any difference. Indeed, he's moving into oil and gas. Well, it doesn't make any difference maybe for his stockholders, but it makes a whale of a difference for Western Pennsylvania and workers and families and communities and small businesses. And to the larger question of whether we're going to have a domestic steel industry in this country. So I think there's a lot to that discussion. And that's why we want people who read the book, The Big Boys, to know more about these men at the top. See, if you democracy is judgment. Judgment is information. If you don't know the names of the people who run these companies, don't know where they're coming from, what their views are, what they want for the economy, what their idea is on employment, on what their idea is on taxation, what their idea is on pollution control, how can you judge them? If you can't judge them, they've got the field to themselves.
Ralph Nader is my guest. He's the co-author of the new book, Power and Position in American Business. Who were some of the chief executive officers who you thought had the most enlightened policies?
Well, I think William McGowan of MCI, he was not only enlightened, he was funny and witty and insightful. I mean, he doesn't keep his opinions to himself. He leaned over once when we were talking to him and he said to us, you know that red phone on William Casey's desk? William Casey's the head of the CIA. He said, yeah, we've read about it. He said, you know where that phone's to? He said, who? He said, it's not to the White House. He said, who's that phone directed to? He says, to a stockbroker. Well, you see, there's been a lot of reports about Casey not willing to divest his stocks and buying and selling in the press over the years. He also said that he thought hard drugs should be legalized. We asked him why. He said because he believes, first of all, in treating addicts as patients, not as criminals. And second, he said that'll reduce the criminal element and that's thriving off this. Now, if a major business executive said that publicly as the society was discussing what to do with drugs, wouldn't that do something for the dialogue, you see? But most of these people just keep their opinions to themselves. And the politicians, of course, are afraid to tackle some of these issues, and they have the same party line. So they are astonishing.
Well, you really were wondering in part when you started this book why business leaders aren't more outspoken on humanitarian issues and
arms control, things like that.
But, first of all, don't you think that in Washington they make their power felt for things that they want, for decisions they want to influence? Yeah. And second of all, why don't you think that they might think it was too risky to take controversial stands?
Oh, yes, because they like to, as they say, stick to their trade. But I understand why they don't want to make opinions on a lot of subjects. But it's our job as citizens to get them to do that because they've got a lot of power. These companies, if they don't thrive on the arms race by contracts with the Pentagon, directly or indirectly, they've got a stake in peace the way everyone else has. And to have them enter the arena and make their views known that this arms race is out of control and that it's diverting scientists and engineers and resources from the civilian economy, and this is one reason why we're falling behind Japan and West Germany and so on, then I think the whole arms control dialogue and movement is going to be different. So while they may not want to speak out, it's our job to demand that they speak out or entice them to speak out or get them in forums where they speak out. Otherwise, they've just got power without responsibility.
It's easy to think that when you're a chief executive officer and you've reached the very top of your profession, that then you can just relax and say, well, I've arrived, I've made it, can't go any higher than this, I've got money, prestige, everything. Were these happy people?
Well, they're happy in some ways and unhappy in other ways. I mean, some of them are just terribly reclusive. The head of Northrop Corporation, which sells fighter planes to world countries in the world and to the U.S. government, Tom Jones has run that company for like 25 years with a couple interruptions when he got in trouble with the law. But he's a social bug too. You know, he is part of the social circle in Southern California with Ronald Reagan. But when it comes to reporters or anyone else who wants to interview him, it's no, he didn't give us an interview. And he runs all over the world, not only for business. One gets the idea, he runs from reporters. The head of Cargill, the giant grain trading corporation in Minneapolis, which the sun never sets on cargo ships and elevators all over the world. It is totally owned by two families, the Cargills and the McMillans. It grossed last year, just imagine this, a private company, $32 billion in revenues. U.S. Steel only grossed $19 billion. The head of it is a man whose name is Whitney McMillan. He's a graduate of Yale. He's about 55 years old. an avid skier. He is so private a person, we could never get an interview with him, although I got him on the phone once for 3 minutes, just a call to his office, and I got him on the phone. He's so private a person that when he would want to go skiing, he'd be airlifted to the Bugaboo Mountains in Canada by helicopter and dropped on the slopes so he could ski all by himself. And the whole Cargo McMillan families and the children and the uncles and the aunts, they're very terribly private. It's as if, you know, they're afraid of the light of any public spotlight on them. And I can't believe people like that are entirely happy.
What are the things that they seem to worry about the most? For instance, corporate takeovers? Was there a lot of worry about that among the people who you interviewed?
Yes. In fact, they commented on other chief executive officers who are spending most of their time engaged in takeovers or warding off takeovers instead of spending their time on their business and their product and their service. When we interviewed Dave Roderick, I'm sure he never dreamed he'd be the subject of a takeover attempt. And here we are, Carl Icahn out of New York, corporate raider, trying to take over U.S. Steel. Although I think this trend is going to abate now with all these scandals that are unfolding and with Congress beginning to investigate it. But still, you don't see that in Japan and Germany. I mean, it's so like Gulf Oil in Pittsburgh when they were taken over. That's all they were dealing with, is a takeover fight.
You would walk into a chief executive officer's office, mm-hmm. and you're Ralph Nader, and they were probably not expecting a very sympathetic interview because you're a watchdog of the corporate world. Did you do anything to consciously try to win them over in your interviewing strategy? Would you start in a special way just to put them at ease or to show neutrality or whatever?
I would try, but they with one exception, Bill McGowan, they weren't at ease at the beginning. They were kind of stiff, but they loosened up. That's why I wanted long interviews. I think they also wanted to meet me. I mean, I'm not being immodest, I think some of their yeses to my interview requests represented a triumph of curiosity over caution. And it wasn't that, you know, we got along famously. They knew that we were coming with a critical eye, but we wanted to have their say in the book. And they got their say in the book. I don't think any of them can say they didn't. Even those who didn't give us interviews, we got their say out of testimony or speeches that they gave. Like Cargill, Whitney McMillan gave a number of speeches on food policy and trade policy and farmers' prices and all the rest. So we got his say in, even though he was by far. Do you know that this man had never been interviewed by the press in his life? Except one tiny 500-word interview by the St. Paul newspaper in Minneapolis. This man has got the biggest private corporation in the world, a corporation that stands as a giant in the state of Minnesota, has never had to give an interview, except for that one little interview about 8 years ago.
Well, are you just suggesting that's because no one asked or because he doesn't like to give interviews?
Well, he doesn't like to give interviews, as he told us on the phone. But after our book came out, in fact, just about a month before it did come out, he gave an interview to the New York Times, and he's been giving interviews now to some magazines. So I think that we had a role in loosening his inhibitions up a little bit.
Ralph Nader is my guest. You've criticized labor leaders in your book as well as the corporate world, and you've criticized labor leaders for holding to the party line and for platitudinous speech.
Well, when we started working on the book, The Big Boys, we thought that we'd get some good insights from labor leaders about the industries that they were a part of. And first of all, it's almost impossible to get an interview with them. I mean, mind you, we had worked in the past to get the worker safety laws through, the coal mine health and safety laws through. And we did a lot of work for the labor unions in Washington who were a little too laggard in going up to Capitol Hill on some of these issues. So when we couldn't get interviews, we were quite surprised. Head of the UAW, Owen Bieber, he never seemed to have time, even though it was over a period of 10 months that we were asking interviews. The head of the U.S. Steelworkers, Lynn Williams, asked us to put the questions in writing, and he answered in a kind of bland, platitudinous fashion. So you ask yourself, well, why wouldn't they give interviews? Well, one is they have a certain relationship with these big boys, and they want to control that relationship as far as they can without having the big boys say to the labor, why did you say that about me in that book? But that's a kind of super cautious. I mean, you know, shades of the old labor leaders, you know, in the 30s and 20s, I mean, who really told the public what they thought of these business barons.
Have you become more cynical about the labor movement in the United States since writing your book?
Well, I've noticed the decline of organized labor and its inability to adequately recruit young people and its increasing caution and losing membership. But I never thought it would extend to being unwilling to give interviews. The head of the UAW in Canada gave us a nice long interview. He didn't just seem to be inhibited. But it's just it's tragic, basically, to see that if the people in this country can't get the benefit of the leaders of the workers' views on these business executives, then what's going on? You know, is you don't have to have an adversary relationship, but they're a source of a lot of information about these companies, and they're not willing to share.
Of course, maybe they wouldn't give an interview to you, but they'd give it to somebody else, to a journalist working with a newspaper. They might, you know, people on both sides might have thought that you would approach it with such a bias and that you'd have your own axe to grind.
Well, but the labor leaders might have thought that we had a bias toward them, and that didn't work.
You had said before that you were studying Japanese management styles. What were your impressions? Do you think that there's management techniques that Americans should still be trying to learn from?
Well, their management techniques, in large part, taken from the U.S. in the old days. Not only that, but innovations, engineering ideas, which were on the shelf in this country in the auto area, Toyota and Honda and others took and perfected and then sold the cars back to the U.S., like in the fuel efficiency area. I think, I don't want to exaggerate Japanese management prowess. You know, we had our peak some years ago in U.S. management in our country. They've got their peak. They'll probably fall on hard times, too, once the founder entrepreneurs move away and you get into the second, third generation. Is the head of Sony going to be as good as the founder and present head of Sony? I remember once I interviewed Honda of the Honda car company. And he didn't speak English, of course. And he had an interpreter, and I asked the interpreter through him, what did Mr. Honda do during the day? How did he spend his time, you know, on a regular day? And there were a couple assistants to Honda who, on hearing the translation of the question, went into gales of laughter. And Honda sort of chuckled because they could never find him. He wasn't in the office. He was always on the shop floor perfecting his motorcycle. Well, you know, can you imagine Roger Smith on the shop floor? No, these people are very abstract, very remote now from what's going on at the bottom of their companies.
As a consumer advocate, I'm sure you're interested in finding the vulnerable points in a company so that if you want to force them to change, you know what buttons to press. Where do you think the corporate world is most vulnerable? You know, from having done this book, do you think that that boycotts are good techniques or bad public relations? You know, what did you come away with?
Well, I think they're most vulnerable to foreign competition,
mm-hmm.
and that's what they're most scared of. Second, they're very vulnerable to takeovers. Third, they're going to be more vulnerable to group buying organizations. That is, people like the American Association of Retired Persons has 22 million people, and they put out for bid their group health policy, insurance policy. So all these giant companies come, and they just, you know, are desperate to try to get this contract, so they're bidding. So I think these giant companies who have been used to dealing with consumers one at a time and doing them in often and cheating them are going to be facing a new economic horizon in coming years. They're going to be facing large consumer buying groups with their own economists and lawyers and negotiators.
You think that's the new direction the consumer movement is going to head in?
Without a doubt.
I guess you're already heading in that direction.
Yes, we've started in several cities, starting in Washington, Baltimore, Wilmington, Philadelphia now, what we call buyers up groups, where we invite households and churches and other nonprofit groups who use heating oil for their winter to join, and on their behalf, our buyers up group, which is a nonprofit group, then negotiates discount heating oil contracts with the heating oil dealers. And so now, here in Philadelphia, for example, the buyers up office opened a month ago, and there are several hundred members already. from various neighborhoods in the greater Philadelphia area. They send in $15 once they fill out their simple application form. They send in $15, and then they can call the discount heating oil dealer, who will offer credit and deliver on time and provide service contracts, do everything that any heating oil dealer will do, under the supervision, in case anything goes wrong, of the buyer's up staff, who, if you have a complaint, you can go to. So the phone number, by the way, is 222-0600 here in Philadelphia. They're ready to take your call. It's a very simple concept, but you know, people take a long time to change their habits. They've been dealing with their heating oil dealer for years. They're paying 20 cents or more a gallon, maybe $200 more a year. Someone comes along and says, look, for $15 a year now, in November, you're going to save over $200 in March, and everything's going to be the same. No ordeal, nothing. And if you have any complaints, your buyer's up office will handle it. Still, although people say that is a good deal, it takes a little bit of oomph to go over and change their habit and switch dealers.
I have to say that this doesn't sound like a very radical concept, the idea of group buying. Unions have been doing that for a long time.
But all kinds of
professional groups have been doing that for a long time.
Well, business does it. And for example, you get a big department store, they bargain their fuel dealer. They don't pay whatever the fuel dealer says. But now it's time for small buyers, individual consumers, families, condominium owners to band together in this way. And look at where it will trend. First, you start with heating oil. And then you go into home repair. You know how tough it is for people to find good home repair service people? I mean, it's not easy. A lot of ripoffs here. Then you say, look at the city will test drinking water, like in Washington. The city will test your drinking water at your faucet if you have a problem, free. Most people don't know about that. Now, how about weatherization? How about energy audits? They're available free. Most people don't know about that, even though they've been offered by some utilities for years. And then you say, well, how about group homeowners insurance? And how about improving the street there and maybe City Hall? You see how it spreads? So from a nucleus of economic power, yeah, that broadens out into the standard of living embrace, you can move into political power as well, because these are the people who are the voters. These are the people who pay the bills of the community, the consumers, the taxpayers.
What other directions do you see the consumer movement heading in? One is the group buy that you've just addressed.
The group buy is the one that will spread into conventional areas. For example, if you think that a regulatory agency is supposed to get contaminated food off the marketplace, or set auto safety standards, or clean up the pesticide mess. When you are a part of a group buying organization like Buyers Up, you're going to have a say on that. If there's another oil crisis, your group buying representatives are going to be able to testify credibly because they're in the know, and they're going to be able to say to a congressman or a senator, look, we represent 28,000 people in your district. For example, you have Congressman Gray from Philadelphia. He is the pastor of a large church here in Philadelphia. It makes a difference if there is a fuel buying group here as to where his church is going to get their fuel and where his parishioners are going to get their fuel. And he's going to be listening to them because that is Congressman Gray's constituency.
So you think that there's two functions that the group buy mm-hmm. part of the consumer movement will have. One is cheaper rates, but the other is more clout in influencing the industry.
More clout, and it'll be more informed consumers. They'll become more alert, more self-confident, and more knowing that they can get information to deal with their confusion or their puzzlement from a reliable group that represents them.
You don't strike me as much of a joiner yourself. Do you ever sign up with any groups that you haven't organized yourself?
Well, I certainly would in terms of group buying, sure. I mean, if there's group buying for newspapers, I'll be the first to sign up because I have to buy a lot of newspapers every day. but you see, the point is, you asked what other areas. Let's take the area of complaints, consumer complaints. What could a group of consumers do with consumer complaints? Well, let's say it deals with household repair. Let's say there's an outfit here in Philadelphia that's a fly-by-night. It's been ripping people off on aluminum siding or on furnace repair. You have group buying. First of all, that outfit would never have been approved by your consumer group, even to service you as members. If that firm happened to get approved and then turned sour, that firm would be stricken from the list. The firm will not have access to 5, 6, 8,000 consumers. You see, there's a real sanction there for them to shape up. It's about time that consumers ran the show. All these free market economists have been telling us for decades that consumer sovereignty is key. What is it, lip service? Buyers up, like here in Philadelphia, wants to put reality into the concept of consumer sovereignty.
My guest is Ralph Nader. We were earlier talking about your book, The Big Boys, mm-hmm. for which you interviewed about seven different business leaders, mm-hmm. and you profile around nine of them in the book. Now, you have many organizations that you are the official head of now. Do you feel like a chief executive officer yourself?
No, because I'm not the official head of most of them. I get them on their own and find good people to run them. And I work with them from time to time. Like, I'm not the head of the Buyers Up or Public Citizen. I think that's the way to really get more talent in. I'd rather have your control grip on everything. You know, if you can't get good people into any movement, that movement is not going to go anywhere.
So what's your way for starting an organization and keeping yourself maybe the inspiring force but not the day-to-day leader?
Well, for example, years ago we started organizing students to form their own public interest research groups. And we hired some young lawyers who wanted to organize new citizen institutions who would then do the good things in consumer protection, environment, worker safety, all the rest. These student groups got underway. We helped them, provided organizer for them. We provided some strategy and knowledge. And they won the vote on campus to add, say, $5 to the tuition bill for those who wanted to join. And they started their own group. It was an independent legal entity, a nonprofit institution. And the students ran the group through the board of directors who were students elected by their fellow students. Now, it just so happens that Pennsylvania, we started this at Penn State, and the students overwhelmingly endorsed it, but the regents turned it down about 10 years ago. There were like 27,000 students who signed the petition. Can you imagine that? At Penn State and all its branches. So now, this month, there's an effort starting at Temple University here in Philadelphia to start a Pennsylvania public interest research group. There's a very active one in New Jersey, based in Rutgers. There's a huge one in New York. It has a $3 million budget, 150 full-time staff, lawyers, economists, scientists. And it's all run by students. It's the most powerful citizen group in New York. In fact, in the last election, the student PIRGs won referendums on telephone issues in Oregon. They won in a toxic waste one overwhelmingly in Massachusetts. I mean, these are heavyweight election type things, and they won.
Who hires them? Who appoints the head of the public interest research group?
The students elect the board of directors, who are students. Then the students hire the staff and the executive director and so forth and set policy. So it's like 21-year-olds or 20-year-olds hiring 30-year-olds. Not many places in our society does that happen.
So what's your relationship to the groups once you've started at the do you visit with them, check
up on
them?
Visit with them, encourage them, provide them with ideas, sometimes critique them, and just generally be helpful.
One of the things you've been criticized for in some magazine articles is hiring people and expecting them to work 7 days a week with a couple of Sundays off occasionally to refresh themselves. And it's ironic in a way that a lot of people who are really pro-labor, when it comes down to a nonprofit group that has a mission, that they would expect people to sacrifice so much of their personal lives.
That's a myth.
Work.
I mean, that might have occurred in the late 60s when we were getting underway, but most of these people work about 50 hours a week now, which is a fair work week. I mean, they're really working for themselves. You know, I mean, if they don't really believe in what they're doing so that they don't look at the clock 9 to 5, they really shouldn't be doing that kind of work because it's not trivial work. It's not expendable work. If you don't do the work in this kind of area, it's not likely someone's going to do it in your place. Whereas if you don't go to a steel mill, somebody's going to go to a steel mill.
You've been doing this kind of work for a really long time, and you've seen some people go the distance and other people, burn out or give up. What do you think some of the secrets are if you are devoted to something and you want to be in it for a long time, you don't want to burn yourself out?
Well, first is you want to enter it from conviction rather than alienation. In other words, in the 60s, there were some people who were in the anti-war movement, and a lot basically it was a rebellion against authority, almost a psychological rebellion. And after that passed, then they were no longer interested. So if you come into it from conviction and knowing the facts and knowing how justice can be obtained, you're likely to stay longer. Second, if you pace yourself, you don't get too frenetic, you don't get too hyped, you don't get too disappointed when you lose that you just fracture your concentration. Thirdly, is you've got to know how to enjoy it. I mean, you just have to look at some other countries and say, where else can we do this? And being able to put one's values to work and save lives on the highway or improve a workplace or make government work more efficiently and honestly, that's a tremendous source of pleasure if you look at your role as a citizen and if you look at yourself as making a difference in society. So if you enjoy it, you're likely to stay at it longer, too. Those are the three attitudes, I think, which are important.
Have you changed your working habits over the years?
No, not really. I still work hard. I still enjoy the work. I think there is a change now in trying to get more people involved, whereas earlier we had to spend more time on exposés because that's the only way the press would be interested, you know, defective cars and things like that. Not that that's not important anymore, but it's not the complete effort anymore either. It's far more important to build a large number of organizations around the country on their own steam in their own community to strengthen the civic fiber of the society, because big corporations and big government are converging. They're behaving more and more alike, and we need to devolve power, and we need to decentralize brain power too. That's another thing, so that it isn't just in a few big centers like Cambridge or Washington or Philadelphia.
Ralph Nader is my guest. Former FTC Commissioner Michael Perchuk, in an article a couple of years ago, said that evidence suggests that President Reagan, by stimulating consumer reaction, has done for the consumer movement in the 80s what you did for the consumer movement two decades ago. Do you think that that's true at all? Do you think that that the Reagan administration has spurred on the consumer movement because of the opposition that they've engendered?
Well, by closing down Washington, he's forced the consumer groups to think of new ways to increase their power other than through the rule of law by health and safety regulatory agencies. But, you know, for the people who are dying or who have died of cancer or died in crashes where they could have been saved if the cars had airbags in them, and for the children who have been deprived of infant nutrition programs, that's not a very salutary comment. The price paid by Reagan's abdication of his duties in enforcing the health and safety standards and laws has been one paid by a lot of innocent people and children. Hunger is up in this country. Malnutrition is directly attributed to the reduction in feeding programs and the proper distribution of them. So, you know, I don't think we should ever say, well, I wish we'd get someone like Reagan because it really sparks consumer groups to think new things. But the price of a Reagan on innocent people is a too severe one to pay. We should think new things, whether there's a Reagan, Carter, Ford, Nixon, or Johnson in the White House.
Are you still supporting airbags? You mentioned them a moment
ago. Oh, yes, and they're going to be on their way. There are now 100,000 cars in this country with airbags. And Ford is offering them as options on their Tempo and Topaz. And actually, the first Japanese company that announces they're going to put airbags in cars, and they'll all go. Mercedes has them as standard equipment, driver's side only, and so is pretty soon BMW, Porsche, Volvo have announced. Imagine it was developed here in the United States, the airbag. And who puts it on the standard equipment first? A foreign car company, Mercedes.
You first made your mark in the consumer movement with your book Unsafe at Any Speed and your investigation into the auto industry. Are there cars now that you won't drive? And you don't have to name them by name, but, I mean, will you inspect somebody's car before they give you a lift?
Well, you know, sometimes you don't have the luxury of inspecting the car.
Well, you're in the position of traveling from city to city on speaking engagements and having someone pick you up at the airport or getting into a cab.
The key thing is to get a car that's medium size or large with full seatbelt shoulder harnesses in operating shape. That's more than some taxis will give you, by the way, in terms of the seatbelts. If you get into a small car or a really small car, you know, the driver is the bumper. I mean, there's not much protection in a crash. So that's something you could spot right away. I hope in the next few years we can ask the question, does this car have an airbag? Because Now you've got insurance. Some insurance companies are buying airbag-equipped cars, like Travelers Insurance. Why doesn't Prudential? Why doesn't Metropolitan? For their own employees. Travelers is converting its entire company fleet of cars into airbag-equipped cars. Within 3 weeks of their first airbag-equipped cars being delivered, one of their employees' life was saved in a crash. So I think anybody listening to this program who works for a large company might ask their company, why not get airbag-equipped cars? I noticed there's a growing rent-a-car dealer in California who wants to convert all his cars into airbag-equipped cars. So we're right on the brink of a major breakthrough here with a tremendously effective life-saving system that will save your insurance premiums as well as possibly save your life.
Do you own a car?
No.
Is that for practical reasons?
I've said I won't buy a car until the first company who produces a car for mass market with full standard equipment airbags in the front seat. So I may have to buy a car pretty soon.
Yeah, I guess people force you to keep your word. Ralph Nader is my guest. I just wanted to ask you, I know that you're of Lebanese heritage, and I was wondering, in these times where the United States is officially at odds with many of the Arab countries, if you've been noticing a rise in discrimination or if you've been trying to monitor anti-Arab discrimination in America.
It does exist. I mean, most ethnic groups go through that stage. And where it exists, it should be deplored and stopped. And whether it deals with Asian Americans or Arab Americans, people should speak out against it because it tends to be infectious. It tends to start spreading. And we've all gone through these cycles in our history in the U.S. Italians used to be subject to tremendous discrimination, Italian Americans. In this country. It's just a matter of recognizing it where it occurs and speaking out against it.
Have you been doing that much? Have you needed to?
Well, there are a couple groups that do that. Citizen Action tends to be specialized. I'm more worried about, in our work, health and safety, discrimination against poor or against unknowing consumers.
When you're buying a product, I don't know if you use credit cards or personal checks or anything, but assuming that you do, when the person who you're buying it from finds out that you are dun-dun-dun, Ralph Nader, do they panic? Figuring like, oh no, he's going to be testing out everything on this product, and if there's anything out of place, he'll be coming in the next day demanding satisfaction. Do they think you're going to be a horrible customer for them to have?
Well, sometimes they start laughing. I've had some interesting experiences. For example, I've had cab drivers refuse to take any money from me. They just say, you know, we like what you're doing and this is on the house, which is nice of them. I insist that I pay them because, you know, they have to pay their bills too. But sometimes, like, you go into a supermarket on the meat counter and the person behind the meat counter just goes into hilarity. I mean, starts laughing. I mean, he knows he's not going to sell me any hot dogs. When you're dealing with professional people, like builders and doctors and so on. I think they tend to be more alert. I think they react to me the way I'd like them to react to any informed consumer. I've never had occasion to take my car down to a garage because I don't own a car, but I suppose that the garage would be more careful and you know, doing a good job. Maybe someday we'll have a consumer group with a badge. People can have a little badge that indicates they belong to this consumer group, which means that they're tough and knowledgeable consumers. Just to signal, you know, to the sellers in these chain stores and so on that they're not dealing with a patsy.
You went to Harvard Law School, right?
Yes.
Did you ever think of becoming a corporate lawyer?
No, I never really did. Right from the beginning, I'd read about Brandeis and I'd read about Clarence Darrow and kind of the lore of people who stood up for injustice and people's lawyers. And that's all. That's really what I wanted to be right from the beginning.
What was your first step toward that?
Well, the first step was to testify before the Connecticut and Massachusetts state legislatures urging them to pass auto safety laws. And there wasn't much response. The auto lobbyists were swarming all over these legislators. And so I had to go down to Washington, and we got a congressional hearing. And Congress was a little bigger than General Motors at that point in the mid-60s, and they passed the auto safety laws.
Did you ever wonder how you were going to make a living being a consumer advocate?
Well, having started out in my advocacy hitchhiking all over the country to save money, I began to learn how to live on very little. So that was really the secret. I think that if I insisted that I had to earn what my classmates at Harvard Law School earned out of law school, I never would have taken the time and the risk to do what I was doing in terms of auto safety crusade. So I think that's key. You got to really, I mean, if you can't have it both ways at the beginning, certainly, and you've just got to say, well, what's more important? And I had no difficulty. I mean, I went back and visited some classmates 3 years out of law school, and I found them in some building in New York, working on the 23rd count of an antitrust suit, you know, and mired in the detail. And here I was trying to get safer cars to save lives in America. So I had no question as to what was more important for me.
You've stuck it through for over 20 years now, being an America's leading consumer advocate. Mm. Were there any times where you figure, I just really can't stand this anymore. I'm getting out. It's too frustrating. You know, I've done my share. Let someone else do it now.
No. And I think that's because I came into it from conviction and realized that this is an extremely important work to do, and it's pleasurable. What would be the alternative? Become an executive in a corporation selling widgets? I mean, there are plenty of people who want to do that. There aren't enough people who want to be strong citizen leaders at the state, local, and national level.
What do you write down on your income tax or any other form where it says occupation?
Lawyer.
Right, of course. Yeah. I guess that makes it easy, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's what we like to say, public interest lawyer. A lawyer is different than an attorney. You know, an attorney has a client, a specific client who comes and pays the lawyer and so the attorney. But a lawyer has a broader mission to make the legal system more responsive to more people, regardless of who the client is, or maybe without any client.
I have read about you that you've always tried to live on a very minimal amount of money and put the rest of the money that you make back into the organizations that you've started. Is that still the case?
Yes.
What do you estimate you can live on a year?
About $10,000.
That's very little money. What are the tricks to living on that little?
Nothing. I mean, first of all, when you work a lot, you don't spend much money.
Well, there's rent. You live in Washington. Yeah, rent's pretty high.
Yeah,
there.
There's rent. But I don't own a house. I don't own a car. And so those are the two big tickets in terms of expenses.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work.
That's a pleasure. Always being here. Thank you.